Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Can I welcome you to the fourth Ethnic and Racial Studies lecture? My name's Martin Bulmer, and I'm the editor of the journal, which is published by Routledge. This lecture is sponsored jointly by the publishers and the London School of Economics, and forms part of the series of centenary lectures at this school, which was established 100 years ago in 1895. Our speaker this evening is Professor Sandra Wollman, who is Professor of Social Anthropology at the University of Hull and is currently President of the Association of Social Anthropologists of the United Kingdom and the British Commonwealth.
Chair, please, Martin, the President
is there. Ah, the Chair. Before I introduce her formally, I would like to say a few words, given that this is part of the centenary lecture series, about some of the connections historically between LSE, and particularly LSE anthropologists, and Africa, a connection actively embodied in our speaker, who took her own doctorate here 30 years ago with a study of rural development in Basutoland, now Lesotho, published in the LSE monographs in social anthropology. And she will talk this evening in part about her current research in Kampala in Uganda. The story of LSE's connection with Africa revolves around the anthropology department, although I don't wish to exclude other departments like political science and geography, and around its greatest anthropologist, Bronislaw Malinowski, who, although himself a specialist in Oceania, directed during the 1930s the International African Institute, which was a source of support for postgraduate research in Africa. And Malinowski, of course, led a seminar to which many leading anthropologists of the time came. The roll call of research students in African social anthropology from that period is a very distinguished one. Those gaining their PhD, Edward Evans Pritchard did so in 1928, Isaac Shapira in 1929, Audrey Richards in 1930, Siegfried Nadell in 1935, to name but four. Others with African interests were associated with the department, Mayor Fortes, Hilda Cooper, Godfrey Wilson among white students, Jomo Kenyatta and Peter Coinage from Kenya, who worked with Malinowski during the 30s, and Kenyatta, of course, subsequently became president of Kenya from 1964 to 1968, and Coinage a senior minister. In 1937, they passed through a specialist in British colonialism from America, the African-American scholar Ralph Bunch, about whom we have an article in our July issue, who attended Malinowski's seminar, hung out with Kenyatta and Coinage, and was en route to Shapira's department at Cape Town. Subsequently, Bunch became the most senior American official at the United Nations, won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1950 for achieving peace in the Middle East, and became deputy to the Secretary General, and was in that position when Dag Hammarskjöld died in an air crash in northern Rhodesia in 1961, trying to solve the political impasse in the Congo. Among teachers at the school, the applied anthropologist Lucy Mayer for many years taught courses in colonial administration, particularly oriented towards Africa. Kenyatta and Coinage were among many African students who studied here and then returned to their own countries, where many of them had considerable influence. And that influence in Africa remains today. On a Sunday 6 weeks ago, I myself was privileged to witness a ceremony, not in Lesotho, but not very far away, in the Midlands of Natal, launching the government's land reform program, and with various representatives both of the national government and the KwaZulu-Natal government present on the day after the departure of Her Majesty the Queen from Durban at the end of her visit to mark South Africa's return to the Commonwealth. President Mandela launched a program aimed at both restitution of land to those deprived of it since 1913 and at land redistribution in a country where one racial minority owns 87% of the land. The dynamics of that ceremony were delicately balanced between supporters of the ANC in Carter and the King in ways that reminded me, in a different setting and at a different period, of Max Gluckman's famous paper, An Analysis of a Social Situation in Modern Zululand. My host introduced me to his colleague, Professor Tessa Marcus of the Department of Rural Community Development at the University of Natal at Pietermaritzburg, who was involved both in research in the locality and in the action program, which was the basis for the government's pilot project. To my surprise and pleasure, it turned out she had a PhD from LSE. Rather unlikely situation, it seemed to me, far in the rural African hinterland. Although there was a catch from our point of view this evening, her field was development sociology rather than anthropology. I mention this event partly because of its symbolic significance, but also because Professor Wallman's own PhD centered on two case studies of African rural development carried out only a few hundred miles away from the location in which I was, and it brings us to her as our very welcome speaker this evening. I hope she will excuse my slightly discursive remarks about LSE, Africa, and the social sciences, particularly social anthropology. Sandra Wallman's career in the years since her LSE PhD has been a distinguished and varied one, constantly pursuing her interest in urban anthropology, contrast to her PhD subject. For a decade between 1965 and 1975, she taught at the University of Toronto in Canada. In the second half of the 1970s, she directed a research program at the SSRC Research Unit in Ethnic Relations at the University of Bristol, moving back here to the school as senior fellow for a further 5 years to direct the Resources Option Program. Together, this period produced two of her most important books, Living in South London, Perspectives on Battersea, 1871 to 1981, and Eight London Households. I will not say more about this work because she'll be talking about it this evening. Since 1990, Professor Wallman has been Professor of Social Anthropology at Hull, and this year is Chair of the ASA. For the past several years, she's been conducting research in Kampala, in Uganda, funded by the Overseas Development Administration, the results of which will very shortly be published in a monograph by James Curry entitled Getting By in Kampala, Women and Wellbeing in the Time of AIDS. She will also talk of this research this evening. Our immediate recent contact with Sandra Wallman at ERS has been as an active member of our editorial board for several years, and we were particularly delighted when she accepted the invitation to lecture this evening. She's also the first woman to deliver the ERS lecture. It's with great pleasure that I call upon you to talk on Ethnicity, Work and Localism, Narratives of Difference in London and Kampala. Sandra Wallman.
Good evening. Can I turn this off?
Yep.
Thank you. Many levels of difference are embedded in this lecture. Ethnicity, work, and locality are different arenas of association, and London and Kampala belong to different continents and very different stages of industrial development. These differences are not only explicit in the title of this talk, they are also socially manifest, explicit narratives. Other kinds of difference are implicit, latent, spoken to work the metaphor in a quieter tone of voice. They may be referred to by the same words, but their referent is the experience of exclusion or belonging rather than the facts of similarity or difference. Ethnicity, as the lead case in point, is not about cultural difference as such. It is best understood as the sense of difference, which can occur when members of a particular cultural or tribal or racial or national group interact with non-members. It's not possible for me to be ethnic by myself, or even in the company of others of my own ethnic kind. Each of us needs a them to make us feel like part of an us. And to introduce the urban theme, the facts of migration and compression are such that an encounter with not us is many times more likely to happen in a city. The crucial point is that real differences between people are no more and no less than potential identity markers, which will be mobilized for group identity purposes only where that particular difference suits the purpose and fits the context of the encounter at hand. There's no logical limit to the number of identity options available to ordinary individuals. It's because work and locality so often override or underwrite the identity potential of ethnic origin in urban settings that they are given special notice here. Ethnic difference is regularly observed to coincide with differences in the way work is allocated or organized, and it is normal for people to identify to some extent with the area in which they live. But not even are all mixed urban settings alike. In sum, the resource value of local identity clearly outweighs the potential of other options, particularly the ethnic option. It is as though certain kinds of local structure enhance the value of localism over ethnicity, and others have the opposite effect. I shall come back to illustrate this in a moment. But in effect, each of the many levels of difference falls into one of three categories: difference which the observer sees, external, manifest, out loud; difference which the actors experience, internal, latent, socially sotto voce; and difference of context or situation which makes a difference salient in the first place. The argument, therefore, needs to be as much about cities and cityness as it is about ethnic affiliation, local belonging, or work organization. At the risk of belaboring common sense, let me spread out the urban perspective I'm using here. There are two crucial angles to it. The first is that each city setting provides a framework of options which puts at least an outer limit on how individuals or groups of individuals can make a livelihood in it. They may choose, in some sense, among the options offered, but they cannot take up options which are not there. My latest model is the ice cream parlor model. You may want strawberry flavor here. You may have prepared yourself to eat only strawberry, but if strawberry is not on offer in the ice cream parlor, it is simply not an option. This applies very obviously to the economic aspects of livelihood, but it is less widely recognized that getting by in the city, especially in the city, depends also on the skillful management of non-material resources, identity among them. And just as you can't choose to use job skills in a local system which has no market for them, so ethnicity, ethnic identity, ethnic organization is not appropriate, not utilizable in every city setting or for every purpose in any one setting. The strand of comparison most relevant to the present exercise is the interrelation of structure and organization in each setting, structure being the framework of social or economic or conceptual options, and organization the pattern of choices made from amongst those options. My second angle on city settings is that there are also social systems in which arenas of interaction and opportunity operate as subsystems of a whole, and which combine to make up its social style. The systems-subsystems model is directly analogous to anthropological uses of the idea of context. The credo built on them is two-edged. The meaning and or effect of a thought or action or resource depends on other things happening in the context in focus, and therefore its value, effect, etc., is dependent on context and will change when the context changes. Specifically, one more time, and then we can get into those real cities I advertised, the salience of ethnicity in any cityscape is determined as much by the urban system as by the original cultures of the people living in it, and it will vary even within that one setting. Who is included amongst us changes with context, and so do the unit and the implications of belonging. Both the London and Kampala studies deal with combinations of people and place in densely populated urban areas. The London work involved a systematic comparison of two areas. The central questions were, how do the economic structures of the two areas compare? And what styles or principles of organization do residents in each setting use to manage the options offered by that setting? Only one area is involved in the Kampala study, but the same questions are addressed. Whether in the matter of employment as such, or in the way community resources are managed, where does ethnicity feature? Before launching into the case materials, I feel it necessary to emphasize that the focus of this paper is the effect of structure on ethnic organization in localized urban areas. For present purposes, therefore, discriminatory immigration laws or anxieties about difference at national government level, and the use of ethnic stereotypes in private banter, jokes, or mate selection are, analytically speaking, out of context here. Notice, please, that this is not the same as saying they never happen, whether in England or Uganda, or that they are socially unimportant when they do. So, this section summarizes the content of a systematic comparison between Battersea, an area of South London, as many of you will already know, and Bow in the East End. Both are dominantly, at the time of the study, were dominantly working class, low-income areas with a growing sprinkling of gentry and a visible ethnic mixture. But on the basis of historic and economic survey of the two boroughs and the ethnographic study of a neighborhood in each, we found them to have very different economic patterns and different definitions of outsiders. Battersea, the first area, was chosen at random, that is to say, from an anthropologist by serendipity, to study the relation between ethnicity and work in inner London. Although we knew of its popular reputation for openness and good race relations, the systemic aethnic style which emerged as research progressed came as a bit of a surprise. The population of Battersea is mixed in a way that leaves plenty of scope for ethnic solidarity or discrimination, but ethnic origin has little bearing on the business of livelihood. Nor did it mark significant boundaries in historic Battersea. On the one hand, no incoming population category has been exclusively associated with one industry or one industrial role, and there is no evidence of ethnic niches or ethnic-specific patterns of employment. It has always been polyglot by London standards, and it has always considered outsider status to be more a matter of newness or non-involvement in the area than of colour or foreign origin. Similarly, from a different perspective, ethnographic inquiry shows in-migrants assimilating to the area with an enthusiasm which indicates that the practical or affective value of local belonging regularly outweighs the potential of their ethnic or regional origins. On one side of the process, incomers choose to enter the local system because it is useful to them. On the other, they can enter because the local system allows them in. The local system is permeable because its component subsystems, as arenas of interaction or resource, are not superimposed. Sorry about that. Each of these rings represents one such arena of interaction or resource. The information network, for example, and the area of employment are not coextensive. The rings could be named by any arena of action. Residents do not live and marry and work and play in one ghetto-like local area or identify with a set of others defined by a fixed set of tribal characteristics, which would account, incidentally, for the minimal interest in ethnic origin. The data for Battersea imply that if the local system were less heterogeneous, less open, entry would be less negotiable and membership to it more likely to be ascribed instead of achieved. The East End of London qualifies on both counts. It has since the 19th century been the centre of London's dockland, clothing and furniture industries, and these have in combination dominated the industrial structure of the area and made it an important locus of employment opportunity. But while some people have moved out and others in, no Battersea-like mix has occurred in the process. Newcomers appear instead to have settled in homogeneous population blocks, such that ethnic boundaries often coincide with geographic lines. One side of a road, one housing block, one unit being almost entirely white, the other no less dominantly black. Local dependence on a single industry seems to mean that when the single industry dies, the families of people defined by it move out, blocks at a time, leaving space for replacement blocks of newcomers who take it up because their residential options or preferences are different. Whereas in the East End case, the old-timers are largely white, were largely white, and the newcomers largely black, difference by colour also coincides with difference of work culture and difference by length of residence in the area. And because colour is more visible than the significance of time involvement, the pattern strikes the eye as a version of racial or even racist segregation. But is it? The ethnic organisation of housing might just be evidence of structural homogeneity, which in turn is explained by the fact that the boundaries of the various local systems coincide so exactly that the overall local system is hard to penetrate and hard to change. The arrows you can see against each small figure in the Battersea-type system, you need to penetrate, as it were, only one subsystem. If you get into a house in the area, you're in. If you get to drink in the local pub, equally, you might be in. On the bow-type side, the more closed system, you effectively have to penetrate all the boundaries at once, all the boundaries in order to get in, and entry is very much harder. Now, there are degrees of homogeneity in the East End, and Bow is by no means the most extreme case, but it makes an effective enough contrast. Sorry. The two types of boundary system are idealized in the contrast between the heterogeneous and homogeneous styles represented in that figure. The forcible characteristic of the contrast between Battersea and Bow is the consistency of difference between them. Every component subsystem in the Battersea whole is heterogeneous, open, aethnic, by comparison with the counterpart subsystem in Bow. An ideal type model develops when the separate dimensions of the contrast are itemized, as they are in the 10 points there. Its relevance to the Kampala analysis emerges as much from the lack of any such consistency of style in the Kampala area as it does from the general implications for social identity which it reveals. The most objective point of contrast is industrial structure. Battersea is made up of small firms and industries, each with a relatively small workforce. Bow, on the contrary, grew up around the three big industries of the traditional industrial heartland of London, the docks, the rag trade, and the furniture. Although these industries are now enormously reduced in economic importance, the patterns of livelihood set by them continue. The two areas also differ by industrial type. In the first, there are more service industries than manufacturing. In the second, the proportions are reversed. Different employment opportunities follow. Where there are few dominant industries, there's a narrow range of jobs available, and the redundancy of any of them is catastrophic to the local workforce. Witness the local effect of the death of Docklands. Where there are many small employers, workshops, factories, however, employment opportunities are both more varied and more numerous. Thus, when a garage or a laundry service closes in Battersea, some of those thrown out of work may find jobs in a similar small firm that has not folded, whether in Battersea or further afield. Travel to work patterns reflect these differences, both at neighbourhood and borough level. More than 65% of the male workforce travels out to work from Battersea, just as 65% in Bow work in their home borough or nearby. Some so close that they report walking to work. Travel facilities match this. Public transport in and out of the East End is still notoriously bad, while Battersea has always had ready access to the rest of London and its surrounds through the massive Clapham Junction railway centre. There's a further contrast in labour movement of another kind. The areas have opposite day-night population ratios. Battersea is a dormitory area to the extent that residents tend to move out to work and few outsiders commute in. because the East End is or was an employment centre, Bow's population is bigger in the daytime than it is at night. Housing options are heterogeneous on the Battersea side, homogeneous in Bow. The mix of owner occupation, private and public rental properties in the Battersea study neighbourhood at the time is still, certainly was then, typical of the South London area, and the housing stock is visibly varied. In the Bow neighbourhood, on the contrary, the houses are structurally identical, and in the parent Borough Tower hamlets, 94% of housing is publicly owned. On both counts, residents in the latter case have less choice in whether to buy or sell, whether and when to move. In the matter of jobs as well as housing, the number of gatekeepers is significantly affected by the same contrast. In Battersea, there are so many routes of access to local resources that it's difficult for one person or group to monopolize any of them. In Bow, there are fewer such gates, and the possibility for controlling them by any one group is enhanced. Predictably, ethnic niching is common in Bow-type areas and rare, perhaps impossible, in Battersea-type areas. Criteria for membership in each local area follow the same logic. In Battersea, an incomer may become a local person just by moving in, behaving appropriately, and staying around. Membership in the Bow area is in line with East End tradition ascribed by birth, maybe by marriage, and is not readily achieved, even by white English incomers. Finally, the political traditions of the two areas are quite unlike. Here, the evidence for gatekeeping and membership patterns begins to focus more sharply. Battersea has a reputation which matches the open, heterogeneous ideal. Its working-class ethos is described as internationalist, and little interest in people's origins is shown in its history. Battersea could boast the first popularly elected black mayor in the English-speaking world in 1913, and sent an Indian communist to Parliament in the 1920s. These elections, I think, do not show Battersea people to be pro-black or pro-foreign. Both men were supported as local people concerned with local issues. Past events of this sort underline the fact that ethnic loyalties traditionally played little part in the public domain, and the same style is echoed at the neighbourhood level in the present day. A small ethnographic item illustrates it. Out of the 500 households in the research neighbourhood, more than one-third are put into the official category New Commonwealth Origin, which is to say that their members, or most of their members, are non-white. But neither colour, nor language, nor the presence of blacks or Greeks are central or persistent narratives. Those most often cited are faceless bureaucrats, ambitious politicians, people who ignore the council skips and leave their large rubbish by the dustbins, council employees who will not take this large rubbish away, people who have noisy and frequent parties, and worse, are thought to charge a gate fee and so to admit strangers to those parties, also a looser category, those newly arrived, perhaps eccentric, certainly without connections in this part of London. Thus, a Newcastle man, 3 years resident, with a wife from the other side of London. He is called a foreigner by a Jamaican woman, a resident of 10 years standing, who clearly is not. Bow East End political patterns are ethnic by contrast. The East End is the part of London where the famous British fascist, Sir Oswald Mosley, began an effective racist campaign, and it is also the part of London which stopped him. It's the part of London where street conflicts have been unambiguously race conflicts. In Brick Lane, once entirely Jewish and now virtually all Bengali, the National Front and the non-white population have been seen to clash as ethnic groups. The two areas are similar in that both are predominantly working class and usually Labour supporters, but where Battersea style is internationalist, it is English issues and the condition of Britain debate that catch the political imagination in Bow. This very week, coincidentally, a radio item about VE Day celebrations made much of Bow's special style of patriotism. In sum, the Battersea type A structure is relatively open because there is no neat overlap of the rings or of the domains they represent. The in-comer arrow shows that the breach of any one boundary allows entry to the whole local system. By contrast, the homogeneous bow structure, the various resource domains overlap more tightly and social entry is much more difficult. Local residents are likely to work in closely bounded groups, and the people that control information about jobs will tend also to control access to other resources. As the type B incomer arrow shows, outsiders can only earn local status by breaching all the boundaries. Finally, I just want to look at the network effect of these two types. I'll reverse the order of them here. If the three circles, which could, as I said to you, represent almost any domain, are grouped together in a bow-like manner, each one having one set of network relations, all the networks in this case are overlaid. You know one set of people, you know them extremely densely. This version shows a tight local community and also implies the constraints of coziness. When local resources are nested in one overlapping system, the possibilities for adaptation are much more limited, and the need to conform is very much greater. If we pull this apart to make a more open, heterogeneous, Battersea-type version, you can see that the scope for spreading oneself outside the local community, for making connections apart from the neighbors, is very much greater. The site of our current research in Kampala is the parish called Kamocha 2. I refer to it as Kamocha, but probably shouldn't, because there is also a Kamocha 1. The settlement began in about 1960 with the erection of a few mud and wattle dwellings outside the then municipal boundary. Now that the city has grown, Kamocha lies within it, but it has developed as an entirely unplanned settlement. This is not the place to go into the details of Uganda's recent dramatic history. But a quick statement of recent demographic, political, and economic events helps to set the scene. I'd like actually first just to show you this, because there are always people in the LSE who like maps. This is a map of the area Kamocha 2. It's quite important to remember that it is 1 kilometer across and half a kilometer up. So it is half a square kilometer in area. The heavy black lines represent footpaths or tracks, some of which you can drive a four-wheel drive vehicle along. Just very quickly, to compare that kind of shape, that kind of urban structure, with the Battersea area, you can see instantly that the sense of cityness is very different from one to the other. Now, to set the scene with three particular points: population, politics, and economics. Concerning population, census data show that between 1969 and 1991, the urban population grew massively, more than doubling both in Kampala as a whole and in the parish of Kamocha. Over the same period, again at both levels, there's been a substantial fall in the overall sex ratio, and so a decrease in the surplus of adult men over adult women. Surplus of adult men is a kind of expected pattern in African cities until now. There has also been a significant excess, or developed a significant excess, of young girls and young women, over boys and young men. So there's an age element here which is skewed. These trends are explored in another paper, but noted here as background to the peculiar gender profile of this urban system. In the foreground of it, two observations strike the eye. There are more women than men around in the daytime. And secondly, patterns of livelihood vary with gender. Most men come and go, most women stay put. Towards the end of this paper, these observations emerge to sustain its main point. Secondly, on the political front, after the National Resistance Army and the National Resistance Movement took over power in Uganda in 1986, under the leadership of President Museveni, new structures were introduced to promote participatory democracy and enhance grassroots development. These are called the Resistance Councils, popularly known as RCs. The smallest unit of the RC system is the village, and in urban areas, those villages are called zones. All residents who are at least 18 years old are members of the RC1. In each RC1, there's an executive committee of 9 people elected by all adult residents every 2 years. This area is an RC2 made up of 10 zones, that is 10 RC1s. The executive committees of all 10 form the RC2 council, the RC2 constituency. And from all these 90 officials, 9 are elected to form the RC2, which governs the parish. There are, incidentally, 3 more levels of RC above this. Thirdly, on the economic front, economic change has directly affected work and the options for livelihood. There has been a near total collapse of the formal economy and a consequent sharpening of the competition to get by in the cracks and niches of informal economic activity. These we might expect to be implicated in definitions of outsideness and of significant difference in Kamocha. This analysis is one strand of a study of the informal economy of health and treatment seeking in African cities. As in the London studies, one of the central questions has to be, what kind of an urban system is this? Because its organization, infrastructure, and socioeconomic characteristics provide the conditions of possibility within which day-to-day decisions about treatment, as about everything else, must be made. The Kamocha parish is in every sense mixed, and its heterogeneity shows in variation from one part of the parish to another. The area draws non-residents as an entertainment centre, with a good market and lively trades in brewing, tailoring, furniture making and the like, and it draws new residents by virtue of a reputation for increasing respectability and desirability as a place to live in Kampala. Its population continues to expand almost daily. First impressions from a colleague's field diary bring these rather dry facts to life. Kamocha 2 Parish is situated 4 miles or so from the centre of Kampala on the slopes of Kololo Hill. A busy tarmac road takes you to the upper end, and from there you can enter into the area by walking or driving down the slope on one of the dirt roads. Here's the main road, and this is the main dirt road. This is the top end. Down here is the swamp. So the lower you go in altitude, the lower you go in housing desirability. It's a very busy place, with many women, men, and children moving around on roads and narrow passages. Officially, there are close to 14,000 people on its half-square kilometre, but one hears figures as high as 30,000. Certainly, the centre part is very crowded. This would be here. And since the settlement is unplanned, with houses being built overnight, it is impossible to know exactly how many people live in the area. The energy of the settlement is immediately striking. Nobody just sits or hangs around. Everybody is active, women washing clothes, cooking, carrying water, dealing with their children, selling vegetables at the market, brewing the local beer, men repairing houses, bicycles, radios, shoes, anything indeed that might conceivably be repaired. They wash cars and make furniture and charcoal stoves. There are tailors and barbers and hawkers and people advertising their wares. It is noisy, pleasantly noisy on the whole, lots of laughter, music coming out from radios and cassette recorders, children everywhere. There's a big indoor market on the upper part of the settlement, close to the tarmac road. The market building is a large square hall with straight rows of numbered stalls and a few small rooms built to serve as eating rooms or restaurants. Here, too, there are people milling around. A large number of women seem to be preparing food. Green bananas, onions, tomatoes, pineapples, potatoes, beans, dried fish, fresh meat, etc. The market is open from 7 in the morning until it gets dark at 7 at night. And then a candlelit market continues outside in the open space by the road. Along the track leading into the center of Kamocha, there are many bars and shops. This is the main one down here. Grocery shops, butchers, drug shops, second-hand clothes, and so on. There are several video clubs where young men watch action films like Karate Kid and Rambo. The better areas contrast sharply with the poorer ones down in the valley. In the poor areas, which local people call the slum, there are garbage heaps and rubbish everywhere. Smelly latrines, filthy gutters, and greenish water flowing in front of every house. Anyone moving on foot through the settlement must jump over puddles or ditches with dirty water in many places. Most of the better-looking houses are located in the upper part of the settlement, facing the good roads, but their drainage system is probably no better than anyone else's. The dirty water from the richer people's houses in the upper part of the slope runs directly down to the people living at the bottom of the valley. Kamocha people say they are religious, but they don't mean one religion. There are many churches and one mosque in the parish. The mosque is at the top end of the road as you enter Kamocha. A bit further down, the large Catholic church, then St. John's Anglican Church, the Church of Uganda, the Church of God, the Born Again Church, the Seventh-day Adventists, and some which the people call mushroom churches because they grow up overnight. Kamocha is also ethnically very mixed. Of course, they can identify each other, but I can't tell the difference between them yet. End of diary. This figure shows the ethnic origins of our survey population. The small groups and the small slices of pie must be very hard to see, but the main point is that the Baganda are the numerically dominant, and not by coincidence, the original locals in this part of Uganda. They have usefully been called the host group in previous work, all the others being migrants, by contrast, and Luganda, along with English, is the lingua franca in Kampala. Traditionally, the Baganda differed from the rest by family culture as well as status in the region. In the early days of migration, these differences showed in styles of organization in town, notably in what looked like ethnic clustering among migrants. We have still to assess how far these differences pertain in the present day. Next in size are lesser but still substantial proportions of Batoro and Banyankole. Technically migrants, but some of many years or even generations residents. The remaining 17 ethnic groups are locally represented by quite small numbers. Because the number of our respondents in each category is quite small, and because the Census Office was reluctant to give us ethnic breakdowns, we did what the official count does and subset these by area of origin. In the Uganda context, region is a reasonable proxy for ethnicity, since the home area of each tribe is concentrated in one or other part of the country. You'll see that this doesn't look nearly so polyglot and probably looks a lot easier to manage in government terms. Now, in terms of the ideal types built on Battersea and Bow, what kind of an urban system is this? The first and easiest question to address is, how closely do all these kinds of difference overlap? The evidence of ethnic clustering is confounded by all kinds of other factors, and to try and unpick their effects, we matched five cityscapes, so to speak. This is the closest proxy we can get in this circumstance to economic activity and to work. Most of the titles are self-explanatory, I think, but the this inner core area is the area which sets the style of the settlement. The permanent house residential area, which is also over here, the market area, the residual area, just because it's residual, and the migrant area here, which is mostly very new, very temporary dwellings. Now, if we overlap these with some other measures, what do we get? The tenants area that is the area of people who do not own their own dwelling, however poor it is in the central part. Income levels, the blue being lowest, the red being highest, go along with these cityscapes, go along with tenure. And finally, ethnic groups, or rather regional groups. I'd like to show you that one separately before I put it on. The Baganda are the green ones, the central region. The blue are northerners and easterners, and the red, westerners. Putting them, overlaying them all together, the green, where the green is doubled up, what you're seeing is relatively wealthy Baganda in permanent housing in the better parts of the settlement. And what you're seeing in the middle is the migrant groups in the core area who don't own any kind of housing, who are probably living in one room of a complex of very flimsily made buildings. In this small area, my point is that the differences of ethnicity and money and status and lifestyle overlap quite tightly. Now, in some ways, this is a very Bow-like picture, certainly for the whole parish, even more clearly for its constituent parts. It is, on the face of it, a closed system, the boundaries of different kinds of difference closely overlapped. If the Battersea Bow model applies, this area should be closed, or relatively closed, at each level. The criteria for belonging should be ascribed, inflexible, most significantly based on origin and ethnic identity. But is it? A dramatic pause to turn the light off. I'll tell you three stories in which other narratives of difference complicate the plot. Item one, football. The parish team plays teams from equivalent parts of Kampala. It is called Kamocha United, and one of the only two statements of Kamocha-wide identity, the other being its RC2 status. More interesting here are the 10 teams within Kamocha which play in 4 annual cup competitions. Organized football began in Kamocha only 5 years ago, but there is enormous enthusiasm for it. A recent cup final on a Sunday attracted 800 spectators. The great majority were adult men, but some young boys and a sprinkling of young women also turned out. The match was well organized, with an energetic referee, guests of honor who were treated to sodas and cakes at halftime, and much shouting, laughter, and jocular jeering all around. Of the 10 teams, 8 represent RC1 zones. 3 are named accordingly, the other 5 to imply ferocity, red challenge, 11 tigers, etc., or to mark an interest associated with its home zone. Youth Alive Football Club, for example, used to be known as Kontafrika Football Club, since most of its members live in Kontafrika zone, but its leading players are also active in the AIDS prevention campaign called Youth Alive, based incidentally in the Catholic Church. And the club's name change reflects the overlap of the two networks. Of the other two teams, InterSport is based in the valley at the lower end of Kamocha and draws some of its members from the adjoining parish. These players are neighbours, but they can also be identified by, and perhaps identify with, common residents on swampy, low-status land. Finally, the 11 Stars team comes from the border area of two zones and recruits largely among the local metal workers, making tin trunks, etc., who concentrate in that part. Teams develop among men with an interest or activity which networks them together. In most cases, it is apparently residence which determines which team a man will play for or will support at a match. But ethnicity and work are often implicated, even if not explicitly. And friendship is not locally confined, at least not for men. One informant used to play for a team, now disbanded, whose name is translated Rest in the Evening. It was composed entirely of Luo men who drank local beer together. Others say that if a man from one zone has friends playing in another, he might well join that other team. Item 2. Neighbouring. 2 quotes to start. A good neighbour is better than a relative. And in the slum, everyone is equal. In addition to being ethnically mixed, the parish and many of its zones are economically mixed also. This item focuses on the interplay of ethnic and other diversities in one zone. Along its outer boundaries, there are relatively affluent families who live in permanent houses with good security and access to piped water. The heads of these households are civil servants or other workers who get housing as part of their salary. There may also be office workers, landowners, or other sub-elites living there. But the majority of the residents live in the densely settled, unplanned slum in the centre of the zone, which is also in the centre of Kamocha. Here there are no municipal facilities, only a very rudimentary sanitation service and open sewers that cross-cut the area like so many rivers. The statement, everyone is equal in the slum, implies both that we share this poor environment and that membership in the moral community which we represent is not limited by wealth or ethnic origin, as it is in Bo. This is not to say that the neighbourhood qua moral community is open to any old outsider, only that the boundary is marked by other than ascribed criteria, as it is in Battersea. Belonging is achieved by behaviour, by acting with respect for local ideals. Primary among these is Mpesa, an ideal combining neighbourliness and respectability. It is a measure applied to men as well as women, but because a woman's livelihood is more likely to be narrowly confined to the immediate neighbourhood, she's caught in a double bind. Good neighbourly relations are for her especially crucial, and a good reputation is impossibly hard to sustain at close quarters. One woman said, "The most important thing for living in town is to cooperate with near neighbours. One must greet in the mornings, and everyone must keep an eye on each other and help out if someone is in need. Provided you've been a good neighbour, if people don't see you all day, they will come and check on you. And if they then find that you're sick, they will make you tea, clean your house, take care of you. We live close together, and if one suffers, the others will hear her moaning. They will come to your aid because they know you are a good neighbour, and they will want to help you." Greeting demonstrates good neighbourliness and affirms belonging in the moral community. By not greeting, a woman shows that she rejects that community. Another woman complained that walking the short distance from home to shop and back could take an hour because she had to stop and greet everyone along the way. Behind this complaint, of course, is a boast about belonging. Those who don't greet must be bad neighbours. They are suspect or troublesome, and they have no access to the resources that others depend on. When asked why a woman whose child is plainly malnourished gets no local support, her next-door neighbour says no one will help a person who makes quarrels and disturbs the peace. She's always accusing us of stealing her things. She's the one who steals. We just leave her alone. The tensions created by someone without empisa can stir up witchcraft accusations. Curiously, in this setting, it is the accuser, not the accused, who is ostracized as a bad neighbor. Only someone who is envious and isolated would deliberately cause a quarrel like this. Mama Beth says, "A woman who never greets may see you stop for a moment outside her door. Then if her child happens to fall sick next day, she can even accuse you of harming it by witchcraft." The boundary statement is plain. There are two kinds of women. Us, the decent, morally upright people who greet and cooperate with their neighbours, and others who look for quarrels and get jealous of everyone. They stay in their houses and refuse even to greet. We, by contrast, avoid quarrels, greet properly, and welcome visitors into our homes. Item 3, the election. In March 1994, elections for a constituent assembly to debate the draft constitution were held across Uganda. Of the several candidates contesting the seat for Kampala Central, two campaigned actively in the parish. In the run-up to polling day, narratives of difference in the parish were more than usually explicit. One of the two candidates was one Kafumbe Mukasa, a wealthy Muganda whose appeal was to fellow Baganda and to others with economic status, usually on the basis of business operations in Kampala. He identified with and was identified by ethnicity on one hand and a package of economic and occupational criteria on the other. The second candidate, Captain Francis Babu, made no appeal to ethnicity in his campaign. For him, on the face of it, ethnicity had no resource value. His father was a Mzungu, the Luganda term for whites, or perhaps for anyone visibly foreign, and his ethnic status was very ambiguous. His support came initially from men in the low-income slum areas. A big proportion of these men are hawkers of various ethnic origin, but rarely Baganda. Babu had in the past helped to get hawking legalized and to arrange licensing for local hawkers. He had a reputation as something of an advocate for the common man. Late in the campaign, Kafumbe Mukasa held a huge rally in the open space by the main road in front of the market. It was advertised that Mukasa would provide beer, meat, and sodas for everyone who came. The rally was well attended by supporters and detractors alike. The particular focus of Mukasa's speech in front of this large audience was the unworthy origins of his opponent. He is reported saying that Babu is not only a half-caste, but actually a bastard. And not only was his father white, but his mother was a prostitute, a Malaya. This bad-mouthing backfired. The women of the so-called slum responded as if to a call to arms. If Babu's mother was a Malaya, then she was one of us. And he is our son. That is why we must all support him. Babu won the election. His victory was assured by the support of the many low-income, low-status men and women resident in the heart of the parish, the men apparently basing their loyalty on occupational interests, the women on the kind of status localism demonstrated in the previous item. Conclusion. For an exercise in comparison, I am conscious that the data sets for these two cities are, at this stage, very unlike. The London material was set in aspic 15 years ago, and the Kampala fieldwork is still too warm to gel. But already, useful questions can be asked and some inference drawn. So, what kind of an urban system is this? What difference makes most difference in Kamocha? Do the ideal types of the London model have explanatory value here as well? Let me just recap the main points of it. By virtue of patterns of work, two similarly low-income, multi-ethnic areas of inner London constitute quite different urban systems. In one, the various boundaries of difference don't overlap, the structure is relatively open, organization is heterogeneous. The other is consistently opposite. Tightly bounded, closed, homogeneous. In the matter of identity options and resource management at every level, the preferred style of the first is localist and the second ethnic. By this token, if two areas with mixed population, one heterogeneous, one homogeneous, are compared, ethnic difference will count less in the first than in the second. But when our Kampala example is measured against this model, it fails immediately for lack of consistency. It is not one thing or the other, not type A or type B, throughout the system. Nor does it fit some intermediate position on a continuum between them. But the A-B contrast does hold for subsystems within the whole. For some people in some contexts, ethnicity counts. In others, for others, localism has more cogency. Some occupations and activities sustain ethnic networks, but on the whole, they are loosely bounded, Battersea-like, so it's not unusual for their members to exchange resources without reference to origin. These observations apply to women as well as men. With one exception, the classification of each subsystem as either open, etc., or closed, etc., is not problematic. The anomaly is women's networks at the neighborhood level. They are exclusive and tightly bounded in ways that suggest a closed, bow-type, ethnicity-driven system, but belonging is achieved by locally appropriate behavior, as it is in the localist Battersea prototype, not ascribed by the immutable characteristics of origin. In this context, when it comes to resource access and exclusion, ethnicity does not count. In effect, Kamocha differs from Battersea and Bow in that its boundary principles aren't consistent, and that there is a curious gender difference. Women's identity with the micro-local area is stronger and tighter than men's. Consonant with the London-generated model, both these special features follow from the structure and organization of work. First point, the consistency of boundary style in the two Londons is an effect of structures which are heavily industrial and of very long standing. The options for organization which they offer are fixed by time and infrastructure, echoed in political tradition, sustained by work cultures of in-migrants. The structure and infrastructure of Kampala are entirely different. It has never been an industrialized city, and many of the formal institutions which began to thrive after independence didn't survive the disruptions of Amin and Obote. Options for steady employment are now very rare indeed, and the informal economy makes the running. In this context, livelihood depends on working every opportunity, using every contact, organizing in whatever way it takes, and any too consistent boundary style just gets in the way of getting by. Second point, the structure of options in the informal economy also accounts for the peculiar localism of women. Relative to men, custom and responsibility give women extra incentive to take up even the smallest chance of income. And there is currently more work that women are expected to do or prepared to do in the local informal economy. This local focus is key. Above the age of 12, male residents are twice as likely to go out of Kamocha regularly, and the main occupation of close to 90% of the women we surveyed is carried out within the parish. These findings begin to explain the observation that there are more women than men around. They also confirm the prior importance of local reputation, which cannot, in a multi-ethnic and heterogeneous environment, be left to depend on ethnic resources. Finally, at this level of the system, and in the core area of Kamocha, it looks as though men and women are in different kinds of urban system. Women live and work and socialize in one place with one set of people. Men, by contrast, spread themselves about. The parallels with Bow and Battersea-type systems are persuasive, even if the scale is different and the dominant narratives of us and them don't match. I'm encouraged to conclude that the London model says something about narratives of difference in Kampala-type settings as well. All said and done, it needs revising, but not throwing out. Comparison lives. Thank you.
Could I take the opportunity to thank Sandra Wallman very much indeed for a very stimulating lecture looking at both the near and the far, and to make three announcements, the first of which is the most important, and that is that the lecture that you've just heard will be published in due course in the journal, and we shall have a chance to read it and ponder it at greater length. But it seemed to me it was a very sensitive structural analysis of urban similarities and differences, and I'm delighted that we've had the opportunity to listen to it this evening. I'm not going to call for questions, because the second announcement is to say that you're all invited to move upstairs to the senior dining room to partake of refreshments, and I think there'll be ample opportunity there to engage Sandra in questions about the presentation that you've just heard. Third, another announcement, and that is that the journal is sponsoring a small conference which is taking place on Friday the 12th of May on ethnic minorities and religion, and Jessica Jacobson, who's sitting in the middle, I'd like to stand up, Jessica, sitting in the middle of the third, fourth row, is organising this and has details of the conference if anyone has not heard of it and would be interested in going. It's an all-day conference being held at LSE with morning session on religion and ethnic minorities in the West and the afternoon session on what we've called the non-West, perhaps rather infelicitously. But we've heard, I think, a very stimulating presentation this evening with much about contemporary Kampala as well as parts of Battersea and Bow, and I'd like to thank Sandra very much indeed for making the presentation to us. Thank you, Sandra.